He's a nice guy. I've met him.
Yeah, he's good. He's
a Renaissance man.
Yeah.
But he's going to come back, and I think he's going to try to pass the bar in Michigan. So.
You know, his mom was a flower child.
Really? Oh, yeah.
She was a hippie flower child.
I can tell.
She was unique. Definitely unique.
So I guess maybe if I could steer you in, I wanted to, because we started talking about, you know, Daniel's Den and some of the bands that came through there, but I wanted to know more about what are some of the Saginaw bands. Maybe there wasn't a lot of Saginaw bands that played there, or were there? Because what I want to know is, you know, some of the groups and artists and individual artists that helped shape what's in Saginaw now.
Mm-hmm. Well, because local bands did. I mean, Dick Wagner and then Bobby Rigg and the Chevelles. They were from Alpena. That was Donnie Hartman and Bobby Rigg from the Frost. Essentially, the Chevelles became the Frost. They were the house band. And they would back up like the Shangri-Las. They opened for the Byrds when I saw the original Byrds there. Cherry Slush played, the Caravans, Rainmakers. Yeah, local bands played at the Den, no doubt about it. Yeah. I didn't go there a lot. I just went from time to time. I had a girlfriend and I played sports.
Well, what about, not necessarily Daniel's Den, but, what groups and sounds and individual people, you know, would you say at that time, leading up until, you know, in the early and mid-80s? All over Saginaw and Tri-Cities.
Trying to remember that. Fordney, there was a guy that was there forever. See, I wasn't going out much. There was the Village Pump. There was the Horseshoe Bar on Outer Drive, the Four Seasons, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, when they're young and good, played. Butch White, they called him Bo White, was a big name in town. But this was kind of adult stuff. The teen stuff, really, I mean, that started with some shakers and move. People like Dick Fabian and Bob Dyer were very influential in helping that scene.
What about him, Bob Dyer? Talk about him for a second, because I've seen him at the bar.
Yeah.
He's older now. And he was a DJ, right?
He's a DJ at WKNX, and he set a record. He's on the air for 55 years or something like that. It was just huge. He was on the board of directors of Daniel's Den. I mean, he helped book Daniel's Den acts. He helped book the Wyagogo. Had major acts, the Hollies, the Bo Brummels.
And where was that at?
That's YMCA.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day. And they had teen dances. So there was a Friday night dance for the younger teens, and then a Saturday night with the older teens. And I went to one of those Saturday night shows with my brother, and it was Simon and Garfunkel, and they were backed by this great band, local band, Jay Walker and the Jay Walkers. Jay Walker was a DJ at KNX. Huge, popular.
So KNS?
KNX.
Oh, KNX.
WKNX.
Well, that's interesting, because now all the call letters east of the Mississippi are W, right? Mm-hmm. So what was the name of that place that's now the YMCA?
It was always the YMCA, but they'd have the shows in the gymnasium. And that's where my
senior
party.
The Hollies played at the YMCA gymnasium.
Oh, the Hollies.
That's amazing to me.
The Love and Spoonful, the Bo Brummels, Lou Christie, Simon Garfunkel, the Five Americans.
It's just blows my mind because if someone told you that anyone was coming to play at the YMCA now, you say, well, who's going to go see them?
Oh, it was huge. Huge. I mean, for $2 a ticket, you got to see these great bands, and they were great. Dick Fabian or Bob Dyer was there to introduce the show.
Dick Fabian. Wow, he was on T5, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he was a great DJ. He's very popular. I mean, we had great bands. Weber School's Motivators, and they could sing, you know, four part harmonies and falsetto. And my brother had a band. The Paupers from South School, became the Ferris Wheel, and they played Daniel's Den in the Wild Go-Go. And Mike Brush was in that band, along with Bob Hughes, who's a DJ with WHNN now. Bob was one of the singers. And they were huge. They were very, very popular. The Cherry Slush, a band from North School, I was in band class with the drummer, Dick Coughlin. They were very popular and played Daniel's Den and, you know, some of the clubs. There wasn't a lot of clubs for teens, and there's bars, but that was the older crowd.
Right.
And so, once I aged out, I started going to places like Hidden Hollow, and I saw Mitch Ryder there, and Johnny B, the drummer, who did all those great riffs on Devil with a Blue Dress, and I was enthralled. I asked him over to my table. He comes over, and I was dating this girl at the time, was beautiful. And I was going on and on about his drumming, and he's just looking at my girlfriend going, how are you?
Oh, yeah, one of those.
And I got a kick out of it. She didn't go with him. He probably got that all the time, but he was a great drummer, and Mitch Ryder was, he seemed kind of sober at the time. He looked, it was a great show. But Hidden Hollow was big, and then there was...
Where was that?
It's out towards Shields. It's an insurance company now. It's right by the bridge. It's down as you go. You're going, west, and it's just north. It's when you pass that, overpass that bridge, it's on the right-hand side before the car wash.
I know where you're.
It's down in there. And so it's kind of weird because you're in this place that kind of teeters a bit. I mean, they're great dance floor. They always had great bands. Ace of Clubs down Bay Road, I think it's Deja Vu now. They had all the best bands in the area. And then in closer towards White's Bar and Bay Road, what's in it now? It could be where Jack's Fruit Market is, but it's right around that area. Where they had this huge club. It was three different clubs for the price of one. You know, so you had three different bands. Peter Tork of the Monkees played there back in 70-something. And so they were trying to build something nice there. But they had a lot of fights. It got out of control. It was too big. Their vision was too wide for Sangamo, maybe. Three different floors of bands and stuff like that.
It's funny for me to think. I mean, I was born in 80, and there was never anything like that. I mean, the only major acts that come to Saginaw in
Civic Center.
Yeah, the Civic Center. And that's it. And they're usually major acts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, fledgling major acts, or they're not, on their way up.
And that was the key. That was what Frank Patrick at Daniel's Den tried to do, try to get bands before they really hit it big.
Mm-hmm.
And one example that Patrick gave me, because I interviewed him, was, and I got all the contracts.
Oh, wow.
Daniel's Den, the Turtles, and everybody, the Yardbirds, all the local, Bob Seger, Amboy Dukes, Rationals, all these contracts signed. For instance, he booked the 1910 Fruit Gum Company. There's a service, and I forget what it was, but it's like a Billboard Top 100 where it shows the emergence of certain acts. Mm-hmm. They're not there yet, but they're building a following. It was the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, bubblegum band. But they were causing a stir. They're getting bigger. And sure enough, Simon Says, one of the Rotten Song. I mean, they did better songs than those guys. They're a good band, actually. Hit. They had signed a contract with Frank Patrick at Daniel's Den for X number of dollars, but they wanted more because it went number one in the nation, so their price went way up.
Oh.
You'd go from 500 to 3,000,
right,
like that. It's 68, so once you have number one, you're at least $3,000.
Yeah.
That's what happened to Question Mark and Mysterious, 67. I think it was 66. They hit with 96 Tears.
Mm-hmm.
Before they hit with 96 Tears, they're getting paid $50 a night.
Right.
in Flint. And once they broke, they're getting $3,000 a night. And what they're doing, they're taking the money, because they're just young kids, putting it in a bag and sending it back to Lily Gonzalez, their manager. Lo and behold, Pete Woodman became their drummer. Eddie Cerati, who the original drummer was Robert Martinez, brother.
Uh-huh.
He went in the service. Eddie Cerati got in there and was the drummer on tour, but something happened with him. He might have had to go in the service too. But something happened, so they enlisted Pete Woodman. Pete Woodman had been the drummer for the famous Boss Men, best band in Saginaw, the Beatlesque band. And so Pete was savvy. He was savvier. He was older than those guys and savvier.
He's like, what are you guys sending this money back here for?
Yeah, I mean, after the show, here they get the $3,000, and they're putting it in a bag, and Pete says, what are you doing with that? Well, we're sending it back to Lily. He says, wait a second, that's not the way to go. What happens when you get home? Well, she gives us a check for a couple $100 each. He says, that's bullshit.
She should be the one getting the check.
Yes. And so he had them take and this is according to Pete, and Bobby Balderrama confirmed it. Let's take a vote. And so, yeah, they voted to keep the money and just send a little back to Lily.
Yeah.
So for a short period of time, they made some real money.
Mm-hmm.
But their career was essentially over by end of 66.
Yeah, they had a couple songs, really, that, right? I mean,
they had that number
one
hit,
song.
But they had like four regional kind of hits. They
oh,
had a
okay.
great version of Do Something to Me that Bobby, or that Tommy James and Sean Dells did. Girl, You Captivate Me. I mean, they had some really nice songs that should have gone farther, but
mm-hmm.
they didn't get the promotion from ABCO, the record company that they were with. That was Alan Klein, later famous for being manager of the Beatles.
Why do you think that there isn't that happening? I mean, that whole, you know, there was four or five places to go see music and, you know, artists that are up and coming artists. Why is that gone? Why do you think? I mean, there's a lot of reasons for it. I want to know what you think led to that.
Well, it's not as fresh as it used to be, and rock and roll from the the 70s. Greg Shaw, who founded Who Put the Bomb magazine and records and produced the Flaming Groovies amongst others, wrote about it. And he said, and I talked to him on the phone. I interviewed him on the phone because I bought all the Who Put the Bomb stuff. And he said the mass popularity of rock and roll is gone. It's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it still exists in pockets across the country. And
right.
it will still flourish. And he predicted that it would continue to flourish into the future. And it does, in pockets. But there's other things that are more popular. Things like NASCAR.
I think, you know, there is rock and roll is, it's not dead,
mm-hmm.
but there's a few, you know, mainstream pop rock artists, I think, that are still, you know, there's loyalists.
Absolutely true. And even the original rhythms.
Yeah.
I subscribe to Blue Suede News, and that's a magazine about rockabilly and roots music.
Uh-huh.
And there's rabid fans for that
yeah.
kind of music, but in pockets. It's,
what do you think? What groups do you think, you know, big or little, are the loyalists keeping rock and roll? You know, because you know, I mean, what do you think's important in that regard?
Well, you know, I think you get somebody like Jack White. You know, so some of the Detroit bands are really helping keep that alive, and Jack White's he has a lot of interests that include some rootsy stuff with country, for instance.
Right.
I think Loretta Lynn.
Yeah, he did the album Loretta Lynn, yeah.
I mean, it's people like that that's going to keep some of those original rhythms alive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, there's a few bands that I listen to.
Kings of Leon. Oh, yeah.
Kings of Leon are a little too poppy for me, but I appreciate what they're doing. And they're not overdoing anything, and they're not.
Yeah.
It's just not tainted with. You know, it's just rock and roll.
And I listened to a fella at Rothbury. Was he Jeff Tweedy's partner before they broke out? I'm trying to remember the name of that band. That's another band that place kind of rootsy. There's a country feel to it, but it's there's rock. It's not that sellout modern country, which
no.
is despicable, I think. But the, I mean, there's people like that out there that are just Jackie Green out of California. One of my favorite singers of all time, he played at White's Bar. He was the lead singer of the Bo Brummels, and he's great. He should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Anyway, Sal Valentino. And he did an album with Jackie Green on, devoted to Bob Dylan songs, and it's just wonderful.
So that band you keep bringing up, Bo Brummels? The Bo Brummels?
Oh, a fabulous band.
How do they spell that?
B-E-A-U.
Okay.
Brummels. They started out trying to imitate the look of the British Invasion.
Mm-hmm.
They were California guys that were folky, so they're actually more of a folk band. And so their later stuff, they did a couple concept albums, Triangle and Bradley's Barn, that were just incredible masterpieces, but undiscovered masterpieces. And so they're known by a few of the older folks like me for their early hits, like Cry Just a Little and Tell Me Why and things like that. But that was just, I mean, they were nice songs, but the real artistic side of the Bo Brummels was never discovered.
They're from Saginaw?
No, they're from California.
Oh, okay. Well, how they ended up playing here a lot.
The Bo Brummels, no, they didn't, but they did play at the Wyagogo.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was called. So you called it the Wyagogo, but it wasn't really officially called that?
Yeah, it was. I mean, because teams got, I mean, the board of directors of the Y gave it the okay. What do you want to call it? Wyagogo. And
like non-drinking, non-smoking, just kind of something like what they do at the what's the place out in the Sticks, that hall they have shows at? Jamestown Hall?
Oh, Jamestown.
Yeah.
Only it was, it involved some of the power people around, like, you know, Bob Dyer and Dick Fabian, and it made money.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought in huge acts
from
England and from America. They're just huge. So they really went after it. And it's and they had contacts. Bob Dyer and Dick Fabian developed contacts that were pretty solid. And so you could get these acts before they started charging too much.
Right.
The McCoys played there, Rick Derringer and the McCoys. I mean, there's just a ton of great bands.
Huh.
Yeah. As well as the local bands that would support the show. Like,
you're right.
The Boss Men, Bobby Riggs and Chevelles, The Motivators, you know, all those people. So it's Caravans, Paupers. I mean, there was a lot of good bands. And Cherry Slush, they played the boy a lot. They weren't quite, I mean, you didn't see these bands in the bars at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that all happened later as bands morphed into something else.
Right.
And then I was gone. I was away from Saginaw from 77, essentially, because
okay.
I was going to college.
I wanted to kind of fill some gaps, because we talked about the White's Bar, but there were some things we left out, I think, just kind of. You jump around a lot.
That's what I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Apologize.
Well, I have a hard time, you know, sticking to my format here, because if you go on something and then I'm like, well, I would ask him a question about that, I have a follow-up question for that, and then I end up leaving a lot of questions. But I'm trying to think, you know, it was really interesting when you told me that, you know, after World War II, you know, there was beers. And like candy bars, you know.
Oh, Hershey bars, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's just kind of, it seems funny now, but it's just something, it's one of those things that would never happen anymore. Because, you know, sugar is you can get a soda for 75 cents. And you can get a head of broccoli, it's $2, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something like that, you know, the candy bar thing. And
yeah, they came back hooked.
Yeah.
That is a comfort food, whether in war, and so they drank beer and they ate
coffee,
candy bars, and
food
rations. You know?
And I'm thinking too of, you know, there's a, you know, Herman, what's his name? Herman? Or Norman. No, it's an old guy that hangs out with Bob Dyer once in a while.
Oh, Herman. Yeah, that's Herman. Shane Herman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Herman.
he leaves little candy bars as a tips. Did you know that?
I don't. When he came in 20 years ago, he wasn't doing that.
Yeah, he leaves little. Yeah. I thought of that, you know. Cause he never, maybe a quarter here and there, but he brings, and they're in his pocket. So when he leaves the candy bar, you know, they're like, this is kind of funny.
Gee, thank you.
Yeah.
Where's like, that candy bar?
Thanks, Herman. You know. Yeah, it's been in his pocket. And it's mushed. But,
yeah, Herman is, maybe, I'm trying to think. I think he's more the Korea age than World War II.
Yeah.
Because, as we know, the World War II vets are dying off 1,000 a day. I mean, they're
right.
Really disappearing.
This is it.
This is it.
So when you decide, when you, we briefly talked about when you decided to really start having music at the bar,
mm-hmm.
and then there wasn't a stage and everything, and
yeah, Wagner Auditorium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Dick Wagner said you should introduce the bands.
Yeah.
Well, that was, we kind of briefly talked about the beginning of all that, but and there must have been at some point. Now, who decided to put that riser in there? Was that Dick Wagner, or was that his idea, or was that your idea?
Oh, the riser? Well, no.
The main original stage.
Tim Averill.
Oh, Tim? No, I'm not talking about what's in there now. Because I played there a couple times before that. Well, probably several times before that new section was there.
Well, I thought Tim was part of the old section.
Oh, really?
Wait a second.
I thought you'd said somebody else had an idea to put that in there. Or maybe
well, Wagner suggested it.
Uh-huh.
Well, and maybe Tim wasn't there. Let me think.
Because that was there when the first time I played there was, I don't remember, 2000. You know, my first big band, Moomboo, never played there. And it must have been 2005. And that's all there was. You know, that's all there was just the drum riser.
Because it had to be, if it wasn't Tim. Now, Tim, I got to know him. 8 years ago?
That had been in there for a long time, though, right?
Yeah, it did.
Because that probably changed a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because. And I was timid about it, and that's why it was just this. That was the stage at Little Piece, and Tim added on the other piece.
Right. Like a couple years ago.
A few years back, yeah. And. I'm trying to recall. It was some people at the bar. I think Duffy. Glenn Duffy was one of them, but it certainly wasn't me. I don't have that kind of skill. But I think it was some of the our regulars, some of our friends that helped put it together. I wanted to put it in, and we got some people to do it.
What about the recording series that you've been doing? You know, I've noticed. I haven't actually heard any of them, and I don't know if they're readily available to buy.
Oh, the White Spar CD samplers?
Yeah.
We've done that for several years now. There's my son's idea, Ryan's idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, I mean, and you know, costs us, I don't know, about at least $100 in just materials every time, because we get about 100 CDs. Maybe not that much. But anyway, we just give them away. The idea was promotion.
Okay.
We want to promote all that great music in Saginaw. And so, and we talked about putting together a box set and selling it, but then did that seem right because it wasn't our material?
Right.
For instance, we're going to do a fundraiser for Children's Miracle Network to cover John Ristich from Denver
mm-hmm.
Fort Fitters. And I thought, because we made up some, we got about 50 CDs, a new CD sampler. And I thought maybe I could sell them at the fundraiser, and the funds can go to
sure.
Children's Network. But I get in the area where I don't want to disrespect all the artists that gave us the material. You know?
Yeah, you don't want to. Sensibly, you can make money off of it.
Yeah, so I want to make sure I don't make any money.
Right. No. Well, you know, you could really, though, I mean.
But we have all those files. We can reproduce everything. There must be 15 or so of them.
Right. You could put together, yeah, a cute little box set. And have it done up really nice, even, and then maybe send it to Haiti or something, you know?
Yeah, literally.
Just have it be a, send a check to Haiti. Who knows?
Yeah, it's great music, and it kind of represents the scene. That we've had a lot of bands. We broke a lot of bands in, and brought bands in that have a national following, too. So it's, of course, those bands don't allow us.
Right. No, they wouldn't. What are some of the bands? I know I've seen a couple of bands that are pretty well known in Detroit. There's one I can't remember right now. They had a song that plays on the speakers at Tigers games.
The Sights, Spinning Nickels, The Mugs.
The Mugs, you know what? They played just last summer. They played, didn't they?
I think so. The Sights are coming back. Great band. I saw
them.
The Sights. They hung out with Jack White and that.
Okay.
They kind of came out at the same time. And they played, they opened, they're one of the acts that played on the bill with the Zombies. They're a classic rock, or almost orchestral, and had this concept album, Odyssey and Oracle, a masterpiece. But it had hits like Tell Her No and She's Not There and Time of the Season.
Mm-hmm.
And they were part of that show, and that's when I first saw the Sights, and I thought, oh, these guys are pretty good.
Well, the Mugs were pretty popular a while back.
Yeah.
And Detroit.
They're good. I love their music.
They're unique.
Yeah.
They're really unique. My brother made friends with a couple of those guys years ago. He lived in Detroit. And then I had this web page up, and he interviewed them for my web page.
Oh.
And that, the, I guess, did you know that the guy that played, does he still play bass with the Rhodes?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, he had a stroke. And
yes.
Couldn't play the guitar anymore, and
yes.
Decided he would start doing it because, you know,
through the Vox,
just because, you know, the Rhodes is pretty bassy, and it worked for him. I actually haven't seen him; I've only heard the music.
Yeah, and I interviewed them, by the way.
You did
for their show, so it was I interviewed Spitting Nickels and the Mugs for that show, and then I interviewed the Sights for their show. There are two separate
mm-hmm.
occasions, and they told me about the. Bass player stroke. And,
right. That's kind of an integral to their story.
Yes.
What?
Great guys. I really enjoyed them.
I want to kind of go away from other people's music and you know, give you some time to talk about why you, you know, because you have your own job, but so much of what you do has to do with fostering musicians and giving people a chance to play and what, like, why the hell have you continue to do this? You know what I mean? Why? You don't play yourself.
No.
I'm
terrible.
But if it weren't for you, if it weren't for Bo White, there wouldn't be a lot of people that, you know, there would have been a lack of encouragement, at least in that part of Saginaw. And people can't come out and say, well, I can go and play on Tim's Musicians Night, or I can at least, people can email you or call you, and you can at least say, you can at least give them a Tuesday or a Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
So, why, you know, what's kept you doing it? Because there's no money in it.
No. I was always a music lover. I played sports in high school, like baseball, basketball, football, wrestling. And I was known as a jock, but I wasn't exactly that. I had a girlfriend that I dated 7 years, and so I was always on the outside of things. So I had a few friends from sports, but I, you know, hung out with my girlfriend. But I always loved music. That was something that probably didn't go with my image. I was called Animal. Because I would throw myself into the fray. I was a halfback and hard-nosed kind of player. And so I always loved music, and my brother kind of turned me on to music. And I became a record collector. I had thousands of albums and 45s, still do. Don't know what to do with them.
Probably worth some money. I don't know.
Yeah, they are. So I just came up, you know, record collecting and enjoying music. And when I was Michigan State in 1970, you know, I $15 a credit card, by the way. That was a good deal.
How they pay the teachers.
And I went to all the shows I could at Michigan State, and there was a ton of them. And some of the clubs had great bands. You know, I'd see Badfinger and the Climax Blues bands or Walsh, you know, just at these bars, these clubs. And so I just continued. And I'd go to Detroit on weekends, see bands there. You know, whether it was Dave Mason or Slade or the Kinks. I saw the Kinks about 5 times. The Rascals, you know, and so it just, music became a part of my life, and I enjoyed it. It helped me stay balanced. It gave me an outlet that seemed very helpful to me. So I end up moving back to Saginaw, started working for my dad, and then, you know, bought White's Bar for him in 84. And it was a nice neighborhood bar, no doubt about it. Old timers, they told me tons of stories, and I really loved them. I was a pallbearer many times when they were old, when I first met them. But I wanted something more. I was feeling kind of cornered in the image of my father in White's Bar. Now, when he changed what White's Bar looked like from Grandpa. So with each owner, it changed a little bit, and it changed dramatically after a while when I introduced music. Mm-hmm. And it was just in keeping with something I really liked and enjoyed. And I mean, for a while.
Did you feel at any point that maybe Saginaw needed another venue?
I didn't know at the time.
Thought it would, you know, maybe this is what I'm going to do.
This is just what I wanted to do. And then, you know, I started bringing acts in. And Pete Crawford from, I think he called it Wise Guys at the time. I don't think it was. It used to be the Warwick.
Right.
But he came by and said, "Bo, you really got balls." You know, because I brought in Lazy Lester and some of these blues acts. And we kind of became friendly. And he did some cookouts, some of our outdoor shows. And I kind of liked that. He kind of acknowledged something that I didn't really think of. You know, it took balls to bring some of those people in, some of those blues acts like Rusty Zinn and the Dinatones and Junior.
Why, you know, what was the risk in doing that? I mean,
because they cost too much.
Oh, okay, all right. So the balls came from just forking up too much, probably too much money.
Like going after it, you know.
Right.
And so.
But what was bringing some of those early people in, like Lazy Lester and some of the bigger names, you had to, you know, arm and a leg bands. Do you think that was instrumental in, you know, kind of putting White on the map? At the beginning, people said, well, hey, look, what you know, I can go see this here. I mean, I'm sure you charge $5 at the door or something to make ends meet, but...
I think it started creating a buzz about, oh, gee, what's this guy doing and how can he do it? And at the time, we weren't making money, and so my responses were, well, we're not really doing it. We got to be careful here, and so from going to talking to an agent, and this is what the guy wants, and I would say, well, okay, I negotiate,
right?
I won't take somebody in if it's too much, in my view.
Yeah, and I noticed that you still, in some ways, do that, you know, because I think I see. You negotiating a lot. A band will come in and they'll say, we want this, and we want this, and we want this. And you just can't afford that.
Right.
And I see what you do is say, well, here's what I can do. We really want you to play here.
Mm-hmm.
And you've even done that with me a couple of times, where I've said, well, we're coming from the UP, I don't have the money, and I'm going to stay with my mom, and all this X and Y.
Yeah.
But you always made it work somehow. And even if in the end... the band only gets gas money, well, they still want to come back and play.
Yeah,
and they're going to bring more people next time.
Yeah. It's. I've had conversations with a lot of talent, a lot of musicians about let's build this together. We're in it together. We both have to work at bringing people in,
right,
and promoting the show. And I think my biggest problem is knowing how to market it, White's Bar. Knowing how to market White's Bar and the music and doing that effectively. I think what gives me some hope in that direction is the increase in technology that's available to
right.
me, to White's Bar. And I, have Eric Schatz working on doing some stuff on Facebook, and so we'll see. It's like radio. I have Denny Lane coming, and in this market he's probably not remembered at all, but to me he's an icon, and he was the lead singer of the Moody Blues.
Well, I think just that alone, people are going to come.
Yeah, I hope.
Well, I didn't know who he was, but I heard Moody Blues, you know, and I saw the Moody Blues when I was 13, 14.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have been along with Tim to that show. I don't remember, but, and you know, I love their music, so I'll be there, you know. I mean, tickets are like $10 or something, right?
Well, $15. It's, you know, I went to a radio station locally here, and I've purchased radio before. I had this great band, a country band out of Detroit, the Forbes Brothers, and I had Dick Wagner, and there's other shows I promoted. And typically I'd get something like 15 spots, a radio spot, and a well-done radio spot where they have the artist's music on it.
Mm-hmm.
I get 15, interspersed on bad days and good days and different times, you know. And it cost me $300-$400.
Right.
And it was like throwing it away, because 15 spots isn't enough. You need to saturate it.
Pound them over the head with it.
And if the radio got behind it and gave a lot of liners and maybe came by and introduced the act or something, it might make a difference. But my experience, and I've only done it like 6 times, is that it never worked. And so with Denny Lane, what they wanted to do was, okay, I hear you, Bo. $400 is too much. It's like throwing it away. $300. For $300, we'll interview you, and we'll interview Denny Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And for that honor, I have to pay them $300. So you have to sign a contract with them, or else it's no go. To say, listen, you have this chance to interview Denny Lane. He was an icon of British invasion of rock. This would be good for your station.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they're not asking a lot. But when it's White's
right.
Bar, we see 70 people. It's a lot.
So kind of going back real quick to, you know, like the beginning of things, you know, you're trying to bring some acts in and taking a hit in order to try to create something. Well, I mean, how long did it take before you really started to see people showing up to see music? And not just to drink, but just you started building a crowd of people. When did that happen?
It started right away. I mean, we had John Krogman, and we had the Purple Warblers, Eastside Mike, great rootsy band. They're playing Wednesday nights and they're kicking it.
Mm-hmm.
Like $1,200 nights. Zydeco Ziggy, great guy. He had Sundays. He'd do a grand easy on
mm-hmm.
Sunday.
Right.
Johnny Krogman, he killed
mm-hmm.
it. He was playing like every weekend. And people were coming and dancing on chairs and just loving it. And so people responded to that because, though I didn't know this, I think there was a void for a while.
Yeah.
And so
weren't trying to fill that void. It filled itself. You got called upon by the powers that be.
It wasn't like a real diagram planned, you know, market study. Just lucky, I guess. But then, I added more and more nights of music, and then I started getting these touring acts, and I brought them in. And
did you seek them out?
No, they called
they
me.
They said, we heard about what we can play here on our way somewhere.
Yeah, so there's a reputation. So then we started getting bands all over the country, and we booked them.
It's kind of surprising to me. I mean, it's not surprising they would want to play Whites, but it's surprising because Saginaw is such a northerly...
Yeah.
You know, it's not really on the way anywhere. I mean, because if you think about it, if you're coming up from Chicago, you hit Kalamazoo, maybe Grand Rapids, maybe, you know, Battle Creek, and maybe Lansing, and then over to Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe you're planning out, and then back into the real world.
Yeah.
But it seems like coming up from the west side of the state, maybe if you hit Grand Rapids, you could shoot over, but a lot of bands weren't doing that, I don't think, and you'd think it'd be kind of out of the way. But the people still came to play here.
And I don't know how it's like we're trying to get. Well, I'm not trying to get. It was presented to me. Chad and Jeremy, great duo, folkish, psychedelic. They had a couple concept albums in the '60s. The Ark and Of Cabbages and Kings are great. They reformed. We'll get them, but we can get them if the routing works
right.
And what happened, they had a show lined up with Al Stewart who backed out. And so that changed the routing. So I don't know what the routing is.
Right.
But they're saying White's Bar would be in the center of that routing had Al Stewart kept the gig with Chuck
right.
Jeremy. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's what the bands were telling me, and there'd be people in the media that they'd get calls, and they would tell the agent, "Well, Chuck White's Bar, they're doing things there."
Yeah, and people will the crowd is there, it's built in. So now you didn't start music initially in '84 when you bought the bar from your dad. It took a couple years.
It took several years, but we had outdoor shows. And
so when did you start having them indoor, you know?
Where it was real steady, I would say, it was 1998, where we really
went. Okay.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, this is like, you know, I was 18 then. And did you do open mics at the time or no?
I can't recall. You know, we did eventually. I remember Zydeco Ziggy was doing open mic for us at one time, and that was popular in the beginning. And Poke, it was a band with Dean Vanston and I forget the other fellow's name. He was a singer, and he passed away. He worked for the hockey team. But that was they came to our open mic night and sang.
Mm-hmm.
And that band became Polk.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dean played with a couple other larger groups, didn't he? Or?
Yeah, Water from the Pool, and he was well known. But I have there's several years where I didn't know what was going on in Saginaw because I was gone, 77. And then I was married in 78 and raising a family. So it was kind
right.
of removed from the scene.
Yeah. So you had the outdoor shows the whole time, but it was like took till like the late 90s for things to really turn. Because White's Bar is now considered, I would say, a music bar.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a venue. I mean, it's.
Yeah, we have steak fries and stuff. Outdoor show. It started out with a DJ.
Right.
And, it was a live. The very first show, it was supposed to be a live band.
Mm-hmm.
It was this guy who was a bricklayer, but in the 40s. He had a knack where he played keyboard, piano, organ, and he had a drummer. So the original two, the other one worked at the shop, were scheduled to play. And it was my kind of nod to my older regular customers. This is for you. You know,
right.
Thanks for being with us. And so they're going to do all that 40s music, you know.
That's kind of what you're doing with Electric Lenny, too. Cause that, I mean, he's catering. They're all his friends there on Thursdays.
It's pretty internal. But
yeah.
Here's what happened, though. The keyboard player was a bricklayer, and he worked every day, and he came in. And he hadn't played in quite a while, so as the day approached, he got more and more nervous and kind of bitchy and complaining. And I was worried about it. Is everything going to be right?
Right.
And you know, I tried to say, well, calm down. It's going to be okay. Charlie Fripp was his name. Tommy Williams was the other guy. Anyway, the day of the show, his keyboard was downstairs. He had a
suitcase?
No, the amplifier. The speaker. And he's trying to carry up the stairs, and he fell down and broke both arms.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Both arms. His buddy, another bricklayer, calls up and says, "Bo, Charlie just fell downstairs, broke both his arms." And I says, "Yeah, right." You know, I thought he was kidding, but no, he was in the hospital. So, at the last minute, I called. Who's the fellow that does all the booking? The Peripatetic. He books. He has a band that's a cover band, three piece. Dean.
So this guy was supposed to play. When was this? Like, when exactly was this? This was going to be like your first show.
It could have been 84.
Okay, you're having your first like music thing.
Yeah.
And it was.
and he fell down, broke both his arms. And,
What a way to, you know, I mean, I think I might start the interview with that.
And that's how I got the DJ in the, it was through Dean, he has this agency, Dean, anyway, and so I at the last minute, I mean last minute, because it was like 4 p.m. when this guy broke his arm. And it was going to be an outdoor show, right? So, and Dean got us a DJ last minute. And that was the DJ's first gig. And so then, and we got along. He was a nice fella. It was his first gig, and he kept his prices low. So we had him like 3-4 years in a row. And then I started this thing. I want a band. I'm going to start getting live music. Wow. And it started out with Marty Veers. And I'd known Marty. He's friends with my nephew. Tim Dunn, and he had a band, Boomshanka. So Boomshanka started playing live, and Marty, I wanted to put in like every Wednesday endorsement. But before all that happened, I was talking to my staff. Nobody, and my folks, nobody thought it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of kept that at bay for a while, but then did it and got outdoor shows, and then finally put it indoors.
Right.
With John Crotton.
So, you know, it's kind of like. I mean, do you feel now that in some ways that you're kind of obligated to, because people, musicians of all experience levels play at White's Bar, and I'd say that an overwhelming majority of them are solid,
mm-hmm.
strong.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while you get something that sounds good on a disc, and then they come in and they're just a mess, they're nervous, or they don't have any experience. It happens.
It happens.
But, you know, you kind of have, like, in Marquette, there was a place called the Village Pub, and there's a lady named Betty, and she's probably in her 60s, and she spent 20 years just booking people and bringing in young people, and it was much like White's Bar, people would come out of nowhere to play there for peanuts. And when they closed the bar, there was this huge jam, all day long jam, and everyone came up there and had something to say about Betty, and there were tears shed. And I remember I went up and said something. I had a little trio that we played, like a couple guys from different bands that we put together, and we played songs for Betty, and I remember saying something like, if it wasn't for this lady, so in a lot of ways.
It's a shame they closed.
Well, it is a shame, and the new place is a great bar, but they don't have any music, and it's a major loss to the scene in Marquette. Mm-hmm. And I'm making the parallels because it's White Bar in many ways. Like, do you feel in some way like it has to continue? Like you can't really let it go.
It's a family.
I don't mean the bar.
Heritage. Oh.
But I mean, what you're doing for the music.
Oh, the music.
And the young kids that play music.
Well, I would rather tear it down than not have music. It just, I'm not interested in a bar. It's a shame it's called White's Bar. I think it should be called something else. But,
right.
But if I call it something else, because I was thinking about that a few years back, and if I call it something else, it would lose something too. Because it is the White family, and it has that heritage, but without music, I wouldn't have interest in being involved. Playing something. I want to have music there. Musicians, poets, writers. I want the artistic community to feel at home there.
Yeah. Well, they are. I just wanted to get you to say that. Without music, I wouldn't burn it down or something. I'd tear it down if it wasn't. Yeah.
I wouldn't be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I fill some gaps. And if like I.